Welcome to another podcast by Air Insight.
This is Addison Schoenland. Today is October the 25th, 2018, and my guest is Richard Abulafia from the Thiel Group, and we're going to talk about Boeing's results and its success. So, Richard, let's start off with this. Boeing has been on a winning streak. How come?
Yeah, I think they've, well, first of all, there are three contracts that lent themselves to very aggressive bids. They were not performance-based contracts necessarily. They were more about providing almost a commodity product, if you will, with a selection process that was something of a price shootout. So they were able to leverage their tremendous strengths in the commercial side of the business to produce a very, you know, satisfactory outcome for them. And it seems like it's a formula that's going to continue with contracts like this.
So do we see contracts in the future? Obviously, these are the mists of time that we have to look through, but how many more contracts out there that are coming that would enable Boeing to exploit the same sort of strategy?
Yeah, I mean, that's an issue because there aren't a lot, right? I mean, you know, these are the last undecided aeronautical contracts for the decade. To get anything big, anything that really moves the needle, you have to get to whatever the next generation fighter is towards the late 2020s if we're super extra lucky. And that's not going to be a commodity product. That's going to depend upon design capabilities and integration capabilities and other things where they might not have the equivalent strengths. So it's going to be a while. I mean, in other words, this might just be a tremendously successful moment in time for Boeing's defense
right.
unit.
Could it be that there's a game of, I've read some of the analyst reports. One described it as going for the Boeing's playing the very long game. If you have the resources and you do deals like this, you can probably weed out and bleed out some of your competitors.
Yeah, I think there's no question of that. They hit their competitors pretty hard over the past couple of weeks, and even though they'll also impact their own bottom line, given the tremendous strength and compound annual growth of the defense market, the commercial market, they're just not going to feel that much pain. So they had a chance, they took it. Whether or not it can be replicated anytime soon, that's another question.
That wonderful thing called transfer pricing.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've seen that you've written before about Boeing combining its commercial strengths with its military ones. And it's the way that came out, it sort of was like a novel thing. But why has this not happened before?
Yeah, good question. It might be a strategy they recently alighted upon. It might be the confluence of events. I mean, let's look at the four factors that went into this. You know, one is the tremendous growth of the commercial jetliner business, and therefore it's the huge critical mass that went into it. That's really that's been slowly evolving over the past 14 years. We've been experiencing this super cycle, the double size cycle, probably going to continue, might even be a triple cycle. So that's been sort of slow to emerge. Their emphasis on squeezing suppliers, that's been a feature of the landscape since Partnering for Success emerged a few years ago. That's certainly the second key factor here. The third is their renewed emphasis on aftermarket and sustainment, which has been over the past couple of years, and that, of course, allows them to take a long view of defense programs as well as commercial ones. And then the fourth has been the tremendous lessons learned in getting to record rates on the 737 and 787. You know, they know more about building aircraft than anybody else on the planet, and they're migrating that over pretty successfully to the military side. So I think there's these four factors that went into it, and probably over the past few years they began to realize that, hey, the combination of these things allows us to be pretty aggressive on the defense side. And that's why it hadn't happened 5 or 10 years ago. You know, it's funny though, looking back, 15 years ago, back when, you know, the defense industry of today was kind of still getting going after the big mergers of the 90s, it became a mantra among everybody else at the prime level that pure play defense was the way to go. In other words, I don't think anyone other than maybe Boeing, not definitely Boeing, but I don't think anyone else saw this coming.
Right. So that great synergy, the crossover between those two areas, I can't help but think about the tanker program.
That didn't work. The Joker in the back, right?
Yeah. What's your assessment of the learning that is going on there that didn't happen?
Just truly a bizarre story. I mean, you know, one issue I think has been, and of course we can't forget that they built 8 767 based tankers in the 2000s for, of course, Italy and Japan before they went to the KC-46. And other people have built the 767 into a tanker too, Israel Aerospace Industries and whatever else. I mean, in other words, it shouldn't be rocket science. I suspect their tremendous core strength is in volume production, and this resembles boutique production, and that has just proven to be a place they can't leverage their strengths. You know, I think they'll get it right eventually. One aspect of the tanker deal, which I think applies to everything else, is that they have no incentive to really bring their A-team and devote tons of resources to it, because it's not like the Air Force is going to walk away. You know, all of the delays and costs are borne by Boeing, and that's true for the rest of these contracts, too. So, in other words, they know the customer has no choice but to be patient because he's getting a hell of a deal.
Right. A fly in the ointment kind of thought crosses my mind. Had the Air Force gone with its original choice of the Airbus 330 as a platform, I wonder how many tankers they would actually be flying right now.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, Boeing would counter that if they'd gone with the original 767 tanker lease deal from even before that, there'd be additional tankers too flying. You know, I mean, it's you can go back in time and come up with any number of
pick any moment.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much this is a worst-case scenario where we're just going to be flying these Eisenhower-era KC-135s till, you know, 2030 and beyond.
Right, then they probably will become fire tankers, fire bombers.
Yeah, right.
That's what happens. Last question. So is Boeing invulnerable? What could still go wrong here?
Well, yeah, couple of issues. One is they're a bit design light. You know, they haven't designed their own combat aircraft and built it since, you know, the F-15, 1970, early 70s. And the next competition almost certainly will be the kind of high science performance-based platform that Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman definitely do well in. That's going to be a real challenge. The other challenge, frankly, is if this double cycle, possibly triple cycle, proves illusory. In other words, the other shoe drops. And remember that not only is the company really extending itself in terms of defense market exposure, but it's also doing vertical integration and on the commercial side. And vertical integration sounds good as a way of capturing profits and keeping things secret. But if you have a revenue downturn, a typical cyclical revenue downturn, you watch revenue drop by about 35%. Well, you have all these cost centers, your revenue goes to, you know, your overhead goes to hell while revenue drops, and that hits them across the board.
Right.
In other words, it's all about the market.
And, of course, we come back to that little statement about transfer pricing. All of a sudden, there's still pricing, but nothing to transfer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The volumes you thought you had just aren't there.
Right. So Boeing, obviously, has to be dreaming of an endless cycle.
Yeah, and one would hope they would manage it well so that, you know, rather than going to, say, rate 70 on the 737, they just say, hey, let's firm up pricing and let's plateau out in terms of production. But I think the real temptation is just, oh, wow, if we can keep squeezing everything and just keep prices deflationary, then maybe we can get to yet higher volumes and just keep going onward and upward until, of course, you've got overcapacity, everyone has enough planes, and you've engineered your own downturn.
Right. A thought that came from somebody speaking to me at ISTAT in San Diego earlier this year. This gentleman pointed out to me that looking at rate 70 at both Airbus and Boeing, that there is not a sufficient foundry capacity on planet Earth to sustain that. So, and who's going to want to invest in the height of the bubble? You know, who's going to want to put money on the table because who knows when this explodes?
Well, that's right. And, you know, you've got people saying that given the tremendous pressure put on the supply chain in programs like Partnering for Success or Scope Plus or whatever else, that these segments of the supply chain are effectively uninvestable anyway. You know, people just aren't getting the returns that they want. So, yeah, it maybe, and maybe even hopefully, Rate 70 becomes a non-starter just because you just can't get there.
Richard, as always, lots of fun to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Addison. Thanks for discussing with me.
This recording is copyrighted by AirInsight.